check the level here. Okay, this is an oral history interview with Merton E. Davies, presently of the RAND Corporation. Interviewer is Joe Todorovic. We are at the National Air and Space Museum on Thursday, December 12th, 1985, at 9:32 in the morning. We have a standard set of biographical questions that we like to ask everybody.
Okay.
And we start quite early with the biographical questions, and that is, if you could start by talking a little bit about where and when you were born, and something about your parents and what kinds of occupations they had.
Okay, I was born in St. Paul, Minnesota, in September 13, 1917. I was the third of three children. I had an older brother, Albert, and a sister, Joyce, and I was number three. And there were only three children in the family. My brother was killed in World War II, and my sister is currently living in San Rafael with her husband. The family moved to Palo Alto, California when I was about 2 years old. So I grew up in Palo Alto, going through the school system there. Then went 1 year to my first year at college to San Jose State, and then transferred to Stanford, and got my degree in mathematics at Stanford University.
What kinds of interests did you have as a child and in grade school?
Well, I had in school I was a little bit had a strange attributes, I guess, in that I've always had difficulty verbalizing, so this meant that I always had trouble with classes and things like English and all. On the other hand, I had the ability to concentrate very well, and I really enjoyed symbolism, you know, like in mathematics, and this is really what pulled me through my education, I think. You know, things like college entrance boards and things. I would do well in the mathematics section and poor in the English section.
Mm-hmm. Did you do much reading as a child?
Most of the reading I did was when I was sick. You know, children get things like flu and often would be in bed for long periods of time, and then I would I've always enjoyed things like history, and I had history of England and occasionally novels. I enjoyed Alexander Dumas novels. I read a great many of his, not just the more famous and popular ones.
Okay.
When I was, in the mid-30s, I guess when I was about 12 to 15, I found a book. I can't even quite remember the man's name that wrote it or its title, but I can give it to you at a later time. It was something like Lasser or Lassell on spaceflight. And I did not read science fiction. at least very much. I read science fiction in magazines like American Boy we used to get when I was young. But I did not read the novels of Wells and Burroughs, which so many of my colleagues read as boys. And they seemed a little bit too fanciful for me. But I soon was extremely interested in space flight, and there was a book by an Englishman named Cleator.
How would that be spelled?
C-L-E-A-T-O-R, I believe it is. I still have it, called Rockets Through Space. And when I got that, it really triggered me, and that was in the mid-30s. I proceeded to find out here about Goddard. I obtained his 1919 report on reaching extreme altitudes, his I think it was Smithsonian report in 1936. It was published about his work in New Mexico. I had Oberst's book, sent to Germany for it. S.N.L. Peltry's books. More recently, in the last 20 years, I don't have those anymore. I was going to get rid of all my old books when my wife prevailed and said, well, you ought to keep them a little bit longer. But I was talking to Cargill Hall once when he was at JPL and mentioned these books and getting rid of them, and he seemed to be very excited about them. And so I asked, told him he could have some, and he said which would he like the best, and he wanted Esnault Peltry. So I don't have those anymore. Uh-huh. But there were some like Max Valier, who put rockets on cars. He got killed in one of those, I remember, in the 30s. There's Holman's book is quite a famous one. I think it was published in 24, where he computed the minimum energy paths between the planets. So then I joined the British Interplanetary Society and the American Rocket Society, and I sent for all of the back publications of the British Interplanetary Society. Finally, in moves, I lost all of those publications because they didn't survive the flood. But some of the books, many of them I still have, mm-hmm. although I find I'm not nearly as interested now in that historical stuff as I was at that time. But that's really when and what triggered my interest in space.
And this would have been during your high school years, by and large, wouldn't it?
High school and early college. Mm-hmm. See, I graduated from high school in 34, and at Stanford in 38. So, I was in April of 30. I was 20 then.
Did you have any friends who had similar interests that you could talk to about these sorts of things?
Not at all. This was one of my problems, and I felt very much alone at the time, because in this country, the primary centers of work were the American Rocket Society, which centered around New York and New Jersey area. And there was a group at Caltech, but I didn't know them, and I really had no way as a young person of getting in touch with them.
Mm-hmm. But you knew that there was...
I knew there was something.
Molina and that group?
That group was active during that period, I believe, or getting started. Their program, as I thought, was quite limited. I thought they didn't have the imagination that either the British or the group around New York had, was my personal impression at the time.
Did you ever do any experiments in rocketry yourself?
No, I did not. As a matter of fact, before very long, I got discouraged because I felt that progress was so slow. And it seemed so terribly difficult that I decided to move in a different direction. And I was interested in aviation. I got my pilot's license, and I was tried to join the Air Force. I took some of the preliminary programs. They had a civilian air program at that time that I took. We flew some of these biplanes or open biplanes and things. It was fun. And so I did get interested in aviation, and that's where my interest turned at that period.
Before we move on to the aviation interest, I'm wondering if you discussed your interest in rocketry and space travel with any other people, or was this a very private hobby?
No, it was a very private hobby. Even my closest friends didn't seem to share this interest, and so I didn't say too much about it, and I felt frustrated. There wasn't anything that I felt I could do about it. Everything seemed very expensive. This was in the 30s, and although I had some monies available, they weren't of the kind. I had enough to buy books and order books from France and Germany and this mm-hmm. kind of thing, so I wasn't, you know, compared to what was going on in the nation at that time, I would be relatively well off, but going to Stanford and so forth, but wasn't in a category where I could carry out any experiments my own. At least I felt I couldn't. Mm-hmm. In the first place, I was not particularly good at machine work and that kind of thing to build hardware, and it just was not my inclination. Mm-hmm. And so at that period, things sort of died on the vine, and I gave up my membership in the British Interplanetary Society probably by 1940, and also I think in American Rocket Society.
Mm-hmm. How did you choose Stanford?
Well, my brother went to school there. I had an uncle that had graduated in 19, I can't remember. He was killed. My mother's brother was hit by a train, Palo Alto. From him, I think I got this concentration, because he was reading a book as he walked in front of a train and didn't hear it whistle. And that my mother happens. Always worried about me on that same score, because I was apt to be doing anything as I was concentrating, but that's, you know, family kind of stuff. It seemed like a natural decision at the time. We lived in Palo Alto, so I could live at home and go to Stanford. And to go to another school would have been as expensive, paying room and board, as the tuition at Stanford was. And so it was a natural and easy decision.
Had you applied at any other places, or even considered any other places?
No, I had not. I thought that the only schools that would be better than Stanford were the schools like Harvard or Yale, Colgate. And at that time, I wasn't interested in going to East Coast. I had my friends and colleagues from high school nearby, and so I was inclined to want to stay in the area.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I did consider was going to Berkeley, to UC, and the reason was that at that time, they were running, operating Lick Observatory, you know, above San Jose, and I was interested in astronomy, and Stanford did not have an astronomical department or any classes, any significant classes in astronomy, and I felt that was quite a loss.
Did you do any kinds of amateur astronomy activities?
Not during this period. I moved to when I couldn't get into the Air Force, I decided that I wanted to work for the aircraft industry. And I always enjoyed going to the beaches. We used to have a habit of going to Santa Cruz for a month or so during the summers as a boy. And so I grew up around the beach and enjoyed that life. So that was when I drove to Santa Monica, talked to the people at Douglas Aircraft who were in Santa Monica, and I knew the beach was available, of course, and I thought, well, that sounded like a happy life.
So you, let's see, this was after Stanford.
Yeah.
Then when you
after
you
Stanford, immediately I first went to work at the University of Nevada at Reno, teaching briefly for about one semester. I found I just did not care for teaching at all. It was and this was my sample. Mm-hmm. I've often thought, you know, in retrospect, perhaps it was that I was very young, and in fact many of the students were older than I was, and I found that I was not just didn't seem to care for teaching at that time, and this is one of the reasons that I decided to go to Santa Monica to get in the aircraft industry, that that teaching was not for me.
What kind of mathematics were you teaching?
Oh, mathematics, finance, calculus, statistics. It was fairly elementary mathematics, of course. As a young man, you're always given those kind of classes to teach.
And you had an AB,
yes.
So we're teaching at a university. Would that have been an unusual thing at that time to be teaching at a university without a master's or a PhD?
I had 2 years, 2 quarters of graduate work at that time. I got my AB in April, and so I had the third quarter and the summer quarter at Stanford before going to Nevada. So I did have some graduate work. I went there in August before my 21st birthday. I was still 20.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my first experience with snow, for instance, and the winter life. But then I came back after that. I spent a semester there and then moved back to Palo Alto and spent another quarter at Stanford, and then moved to Southern California. I decided not to pursue I had to write a thesis for a master's, and I decided to just start working rather than to go on for a master's or a PhD, although my professors at the time were trying to encourage me to do that. I felt it was time to start working.
Mm-hmm.
I thought at the time I might have stayed on and tried for a degree if I could have gotten it by the time I was 23, and it seemed as though I couldn't do it, and I was just of a mind to leave.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you went to Santa Monica. How did you choose Douglas?
Mostly because it was in Santa Monica. Lockheed was in Burbank, and North American was farther away. It was a matter of just convenience and also being familiar with the Douglas aircraft. So it was not a question of knowing anybody at all. As a matter of fact, I just walked in the door. And also, you know, particularly at that time, a math major had not too many options at work. It was not at all like engineering. When I was in school, I was told there were two possible careers in mathematics. One was teaching, and the other was actuarial work for life insurance companies. And this was sort of the options that the personnel department at Stanford would give you as a math major. And so my expectations were not too great when I went to Douglas.
Let me just back up just a little bit and pick up on that. You persisted through a fair amount of graduate work in mathematics, thinking that the only options for later professional work would either be teaching or actuarial work. Were you considering any kind of actuarial work or applied mathematics like that, or what kept you going through your graduate study?
Mostly the interest in mathematics. I enjoyed the fact that it was viewed as an avocation, that my interests were primarily in geometry of numbers and completely useless sort of subjects in mathematics. In other words, the ones that were not at all applied. And I guess if anything, it was mostly it was a matter of just personal interest and satisfaction, like solving a puzzle, more than trying to look after one's career and future. At that time, I wasn't particularly concerned or worried about that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you show up at Douglas, and what kind of a reception did you get?
Fine. Douglas at that time, it seemed to me, were getting ready for World War II. They were beginning to get into production of quite a few aircraft. These were the ones that were being sent lend-lease to the British and French. It was just before World War II. And they were expanding. And I think my impression was that anybody with a college degree, they were glad to see. And it was almost that simple. They had a list of all kinds of jobs and people that they wanted to match up with those jobs. And it was just a matter of finding something that was agreeable.
Mm-hmm. Had you done much flying at this time beyond that one?
Oh yes, I had a private pilot's license for about 4 years at that time. I had decided, I did a great deal of flying in Reno when I was there, and then in Palo Alto also. In Reno, I spent all my paycheck on flying. But Southern California, I more or less decided to give it up, because I decided that I could not get in the Air Force at that time, and I realized that it was such an expensive hobby that I didn't see how I could pursue it. And by then I began to be a little bit more serious about, or thinking a little bit more about life and life's careers.
Mm-hmm. Why were you not able to get into the Air Force, if you don't mind?
I'm too tall.
Too tall.
They had a 6'4 limit, and I'm about 6'8. Now, the Army had a 6'6 limit, and I could possibly have squeezed into the Army, but I couldn't fly in the Army. To get on flight status, you had to be 6'4. My brother was 6'4, and he was a navigator.
Mm-hmm.
In the Air Force.
Okay. Where did you start working at Douglas? Were you hired immediately?
The tooling division at that time was very anxious for me to work there. So I did go into the tooling division rather than engineering. And I was working in what was called a lofting department. I don't know if you're familiar with lofting, but this is where they came from the shipbuilding industry, where they lay out all of the lines, exterior lines of a ship or an airplane to define its shape, its aerodynamic shape. And so lofting, you work very closely with the aerodynamic engineers and in this sort of thing. Now at Douglas they had introduced a new system of lofting, where we would write mathematical equations for these lines rather than draw them on the floor the way they did in the shipbuilding industry. And
okay. So
this is where I could just write equations for these for the lines and could solve for offsets to make the sections for the ribs and all these kinds of things that go in between the shaping of the aircraft.
The requirements, I would imagine, for ships and planes at that level, not the specific requirements, but the general approach is probably the same. You've got a body moving through a fluid. The density is different.
Yes, that's exactly right. These things, the aircraft industry borrowed from the shipbuilding industry in this regard, and they introduced these same methods of lofting. Now, Douglas was the first company to go into mathematical lofting, and it was developed there by a man named Johnny Apolitegi. And
you could help me with the spelling on that,
I'd almost have to look it up.
That's
A-P-P.
Okay.
Apolitegui. His name is Basque, from Basque area of Spain. His family were sheep herders in California mountains. Delightful guy. I still know him. And so he was my boss, and he was. We got along well. He was delighted to have me there because I knew a lot more about writing equations than most of the people he had available.
Were a lot of the people that were in there already, were they people who had been doing the lofting work in the old method and then were trying to learn the mathematics of the shapes? Because it seems to me that this kind of you're verging on topology if you're not already in topology, when you have to deal with the kinds of curves, let alone surfaces and three-dimensional considerations.
You're absolutely right. The they had a group which were called the lines group, and these were the people who made the boards. They used aluminum sheeting that was spray painted, and they would draw the lines of cross sections to make the ribs in these sorts of parts. Mm-hmm. And these were people who had used the old method of lofting, that would lay out a full-size length and then take cuts through it to make these ribs cross sections, you see.
Would they work at actual full scale,
yes,
right out on the
floor? That's exactly right.
They no had to, models or
no,
anything
like that? No, they had to make
like
them full size on big sheets of aluminum. Visualize spray painting a large sheet of aluminum, and then they would use a sharp knife which had a little hook, and they had these splines, and they would have little weights which would hold the splines down, and then they would scribe with the knife through the shape, and that would make the line of this rib, and from that it would go into another department, and they would form, allow for the skin thickness of the outer skin of the aircraft, mm-hmm. and actually form a rib to an engineering shape inside that line.
So they were making templates.
That's right. These
were actually going to be used for production.
Oh, yes, that's right. This is the tooling department. We were making the tools by which all these things were formed. Then mm-hmm. we were in control of the shapes, the exterior shapes, the aerodynamic shapes of the aircraft. That's what it was. And we did it then by this. There was the computing subgroup, which before long I got sent to this El Segundo plant from the Santa Monica plant. And before long, I was head of the mathematical computing part of that, you see, and had about three or four people doing computing. And they had a similar parallel group at Santa Monica, working on the Santa Monica aircraft. El Segundo was being run by Ed Heinemann, who's a pretty famous man. And Gene Root was there, head of aerodynamics, and Bill Ballhouse was there, and quite a few well-known people came out of that that group. Mm. That was where I met Gene Root, and you know, he went to Rand and then to Lockheed. At any rate, I was in tooling and they were in engineering, but our offices were right next to each other because we had to work with the engineers that were defining these shapes and computing things. And because we had the computing capability, we would do like flutter analysis, which was just coming into work, working with the aerodynamicists to worry about flutter. Before those days, you know, we didn't worry about flutter and some of these other problems that were intensive computational problems.
Mm-hmm. Now, previously, the design engineers had been working, I would assume, pretty closely, hour by hour, with the lines people.
Normally, the engineers, the aerodynamicists, would work on a small-scale drawing, and then from that, we would take it, and with a few measurements, they would usually define a few measurements that they thought were more or less important to hold to hold their aerodynamic shapes, and that would go to us, and then we would write equations for these things that matched their lines approximately.
Curve fitting.
But we would do it with an equation rather than with a spline. They were using a spline. And these define the, once we had an equations for it, then we could go to our lines people and give them cross sections through these shapes. And mm-hmm. we also had, of course, did a great deal of work on the wings and defining all the spars and things through the wings. Now, on these aircraft, another bit of work that we got involved with, particularly a colleague there, Wayne White, who was became a very good friend of mine. He had come out of Caltech, and he and I got into a lot of dimensioning of fittings, because we'd have these folding wings, and you'd have a hinge line, which was, you know, at a crazy angles with the spars and things, and then they'd have a big fitting which had to take all the loads of transferring it to carry the weight of the outer wing that was going to fold, and these fittings were both large, and they had machined surfaces that were canted at funny angles, and the hinge lines were defined essentially in one coordinate system, and what it turned out was that the fittings, to machine them, they had to be put into a different coordinate system. And it also turned out, you know, that the engineers who were doing this just weren't accustomed to this kind of thing, and it was one of the things that a bit of analytical geometry that Wayne White and I got very proficient at. And so we would work with the machine shop at times and in, you know, telling them how to rotate and set up a and make a cut with the machine.
So the engineers, between the engineers and the actual production machinists, there is a gap.
It's a tooling. That's where tooling comes in, which builds the tools so that the production operation is very rapid and does not take skilled labor. Mm-hmm. If the tools are built correctly, all they do is slap a fitting in and go zoom, and it cuts things correctly, you see.
Right.
And then you have to dimension everything relative to the face that you just cut. And you have to have a smooth surface to work from. And then you make the successive cuts, and the tool does all of this, and it dimensions it all so that when the part comes out, it fits together, and the hinge line is a straight line. And
right.
Oh, it all fits. And right. The spars, of course, are quite far apart, the front and rear spars, and these things all have to fit when they're finally assembled.
But there's also a conceptual gap between the engineers and the machinist. You mentioned different coordinate systems. And I kind of get the idea that you and your group are mediating or translating.
That was right.
You have to have a sensitivity to the engineers and a sensitivity to the machinists.
That's right. We worked between those two groups a great deal. It turned out we hadn't started. That wasn't exactly our job. It's just that the machinists are typical people that you find in the shops, and it was very difficult for them to interpret these engineering drawings and to make these cuts at the proper angles to fit.
And had the engineers considered an error budget at all? Were the engineers taking account of what the design engineers taking account of what the machinists would have to deal with in terms of error budgets in making these parts and tolerances?
The design engineer did not. They had a group which was called checkers. They checked all of the, their role was to check all the dimensions and in fact to make detail, they would check the dimensioning of the detailed drawings of parts from the engineers. And so the checkers were the ones that really had were responsible in the bottom line for dimensioning the parts. And so we worked very closely with the checkers because it turned out that they were the engineering checkers, but our offices were right next door, and they would usually call us on questions like this when there were complex machine cuts to be made to make sure that the angles and all were on the engineering drawings correctly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now this was the sort of work that went on during all of my career at Douglas. I was at El Segundo essentially the full time, commuting from Santa Monica.
And that's
up until 47, from about 1939 or 40 to 47.
Mm-hmm. I take it, did you find this work challenging and interesting?
It was initially, and of course, after a while it became fairly routine. I had my favorite airplanes. I enjoyed working, for instance, on that 558 Phase 1 and Phase 2. The Phase 1 was the turbojet, one of the first turbojets that this country built. Phase 2 was the rocket airplane, which Reaction Motors had built the engine for it. It was, this came from the people, and at that time my interest in rocketry and space came back because I recognized that the group of people who had been in the old American Rocket Society in the 30s by this time had formed a company called Reaction Motors.
Yes.
And I'd never met them. I just recognized the names. And of course, the group at Caltech formed JPL and then Aerojet, or were about to. And I had heard in 47 that that Douglas had organized the RAND project out of the Santa Monica plant. And so Wayne White had knew the people better than I did, so he transferred to it, and I transferred to RAND shortly after he did.
Were you, you weren't directly in touch with any of the people at Reaction Motors or JPL?
No, I was not, not at all.
But you definitely, you're in a position to hear, and being in the area and in the kind of job that you're in a position to hear about things going on like
that's the way the word traveled? We knew, for instance, you know, who was building the engines for the 558 Phase 2. These were well publicized, especially when they were behind schedule and held up the delivery and this sort of thing. They had quite a bit of, quite a few problems with that motor getting it reliable enough for flight. Mm-hmm. Once I went to RAND, RAND had open access to all kinds of material from all of the companies. And so soon, including captured documents, I went through all of the captured documents about the German A4 and, you know, discussions of the German plans and thoughts. Pretty soon you read enough of these, you know, that learn the names of the individuals. They become as though you knew them, because they would be talking about all of their things.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting historically to go through these things. We were very well informed on the activities that the Air Force was starting at that time. There were some Navy studies of rockets, which we had access to, and these were the ones which Cargill Hall wrote about that was that preceded RAND's study, or were almost parallel with it.
Yes. Before we get to RAND, I'd just like to talk a little bit more about the aircraft that is in this museum in front of the planetarium, because you mentioned that you did the some of the work on designing the aerodynamic surfaces of that particular vehicle. I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about when that project came through.
I don't remember the dates, but I believe it was right after the end of the war, 45, 46, that we started these two experimental airplanes. Gene Root was heavily involved because they were the first aircraft that that the El Segundo team had worked on, which were near sonic speed and supersonic, and so we got into realms of aerodynamics, which was new and challenging. And in terms of our work of defining shapes, the shapes were relatively simple. They were not the complex shapes that were so extremely challenging on aircraft like the SB-2D, which, and they did not have the folding wings, and the lines were very smooth, and so they were very simple.
I have to flip the tape over. I'm getting an end of tape alarm here. This is the end of tape one, side one. Continues on tape one, side two.